I'd like to remind us all of some of the words that we heard the other night, the first discourse of the Buddha, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. I'd like to just reread the first two paragraphs. I've heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying at Varanasi in the game refuge at Isipatana. There he addressed the group of five monks. There are these two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth. Which two? That which is devoted to sensual pleasures with reference to sensual objects, base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable. And that which is devoted to self-affliction, painful, ignoble, unprofitable. Avoiding both these extremes, the middle way realized by the Tathagata, producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, leads to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. And what is the middle way realized by the Tathagata, that producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding? Precisely this Noble Eightfold Path, right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This is the middle way realized by the Tathagata, that producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. I like the fact that the first discourse of the Buddha begins with the Eightfold Path. I'd actually forgotten that. I think about the first discourse of the Buddha being a discourse on the Four Noble Truths and the actions associated with the Four Noble Truths, but I had forgotten that he begins by talking about the Eightfold Path and the fact that that is what leads to our awakening. And so that's what I'd like to explore today in the talk, is how that's possible. My understanding of how that might be possible. So, I'm not going to do a detailed description of the Eightfold Path. As I was thinking about this talk to give to this group, I thought, oh, this is so great. You all know this stuff already. So I can really, I'm going to kind of skim the surface of the Eightfold Path and then talk in a little more depth about how I understand that this path leads to freedom. So the Eightfold Path, as many of you know, is divided into three aspects or three groups: the wisdom aspect, the ethical conduct aspect, and the mental cultivation, what I'll call the mental cultivation aspect. And each of the factors of the Eightfold Path fits into one of these aspects. So the first two factors of the Eightfold Path, wise understanding and wise intention, fit into the wisdom aspect of the Eightfold Path. The third, fourth, and fifth factors, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, fit into the ethical conduct section of the Eightfold Path. And the last three factors, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, are part of the mental cultivation aspect. So the path begins with wisdom, with a form of wisdom. Not the full-blown wisdom that is the fruition of our practice, but with some learning, some receiving of information. So we need to start our path with understanding something about where we're going. And the where we're going on this path is set up by, defined by, essentially what the Buddha thought of as the problem of the human condition, the reason why we struggle, this aspect, this thing in our minds, thing that our minds does, which the Buddha called dukkha, translated usually as suffering, but also translated as stress, dissatisfaction, unease. So the Eightfold Path with right understanding needs to begin with some understanding of what this dukkha is and how it is caused. So one of the primary ways that this first factor is defined is as an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. This is suffering. There is suffering, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So the Four Noble Truths, the statement of the Four Noble Truths, includes several pieces that I'd like to just highlight here. One, it starts with essentially what is this dukkha? There is dukkha, there is this suffering. Now this isn't, of course, just unpleasant circumstance, but is rather the way we react to circumstance that is what this dukkha is, this suffering, this distress, this dissatisfaction, this unease is. Largely it happens because we're resisting the way things are, or we're trying to hold on to things and keep them. Essentially, we can look at these two, you know, this aspect of don't like this, want to get rid of this, push it away, or hold on, as being two versions of the two extremes the Buddha talked about, you know, that which is devoted to sensual pleasure and that which is devoted to self-affliction. You know, in a way, we can see how, as we hold on to things, that is a kind of a habitual way that we try to find happiness. And yet, one teacher, it might not have even been a teacher, it might have been a teacher describing what a yogi described in an interview, described this kind of strategy for happiness, of holding on to what we like, as the suffering of that is like rote burn, because we're trying to hold on to something that is just slipping through our grasp. And it burns us as we try to hold on to it. So we try to hold on to things we like, and it will cause suffering because of the inevitability of the change. We want to push away things we don't like. This causes suffering in the moment because that aversive experience is already unpleasant, and we are suffering from the reactivity to an unpleasant experience. So we think, in our moments of less freedom, and before we met the practice, we think that the way to happiness is to arrange my world to be the way I'd like it to be. And the strategy is ultimately not very satisfying. And it points itself out to us that it's not very satisfying over and over again, only we don't think of it as being just the way things are. We think, well, what have I done wrong? Why am I failing here? Why am I not able to arrange things the way I'd like them to be? Rainer Maria Rilke points to this in one of his elegies, his Duino elegies. This is an excerpt from his eighth Duino elegy. And we, spectators, always, everywhere, turn toward the world of objects. It fills us. We arrange it. It breaks down. We rearrange it and then break down ourselves. You know, this it's not a mistake that things break down. It's the way it is. So the process around dissatisfaction, this process around the dukkha, the struggle, the suffering that we experience, the vast majority of what we struggle about is a process that's in our own minds. It's created by resistance, reactivity, holding on, clinging, craving. And so initially, wise understanding, this first aspect of the path, initially begins with understanding something about this suffering, understanding that it is created by our minds. So the Four Noble Truths also point to cause and effect, how certain actions, certain states of mind will lead us towards suffering, lead us towards this struggle, this dissatisfaction, and other states of mind will lead us more towards happiness. And so this is another part of the Eightfold Path and the practice that we engage with, that we begin to understand what supports us moving away from suffering and towards happiness, and we begin to understand something about the cause and effect nature of our experience, how we can begin to turn our minds in a direction away from habitual reactivity and more towards skillful, beautiful, wholesome qualities of mind. So we begin our practice with not the deep understanding of these truths, of these Four Noble Truths, but with a reflective understanding. We hear information about these truths. We perhaps also experience or see some people who've been practicing these Four Noble Truths, and we think, wow, they know something I'd like to know. And it encourages us or inspires us to practice too. So we begin with just this kind of intellectual understanding, and it moves us into a place of intention, the second aspect of the Eightfold Path, to intend to engage with the practice, to intend to cultivate those qualities that take us more towards happiness. And the Buddha highlighted kindness, compassion, and wisdom as being intentions to cultivate. So as we engage in this reflective understanding and intention begins to arise for us to practice the Eightfold Path, we begin to actually want to start practicing things that will support this movement towards happiness. So the second three factors of the Eightfold Path, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, are practices that support our engagement with the world, support our field of relationships, really, that we cultivate harmonizing our relationships in our outer world as a support for this movement towards happiness, towards freedom. We begin to live more peacefully with a heart that inclines towards non-harming. So the last three aspects of the Eightfold Path, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, I put these in what I called mental development section of the Eightfold Path. Why would we need to develop our minds? This really links back to the actual cause of our struggles. The cause of our struggles is in our minds. The vast majority of what we struggle about is created by our own minds. And so a training in the mind, and actually it's good news, it's really good news that the vast majority of our struggles are created by our minds, because if it were something outside of our minds, there would be no hope to find happiness. And so this training begins to help us understand, how is it that my mind is contributing to my struggle? So we practice wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. We make the effort to stay connected to our experience, to explore the present moment, to cultivate wholesome, beautiful states of mind, and to let go of difficult, unwholesome states of mind. Mindfulness allows us to recognize what's happening and to stay with the experience. And wise effort and wise mindfulness together cultivate wise concentration. So the Eightfold Path, I've been talking about it as practices. You know, it's not just an idea, it's something that we engage with. And we, here on retreat especially, we engage with it moment after moment. We engage with wise understanding and wise intention. You wouldn't be here if you weren't engaging with wise understanding and wise intention. The fact that you are here practicing, the fact that you come into the hall to sit, is a manifestation of wise understanding and wise intention. The fact that you sit and walk, the fact that you explore, bring attention to your experience, these are manifestations of wise understanding and wise intention. So we're living those aspects moment to moment. Wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. On one retreat, I was in Burma, where one of my teachers, Sayadaw Ujanaka, gave a talk where he did explore how we're practicing the Eightfold Path in a single moment. He talked about it, in a single moment, you're practicing the Eightfold Path. And he described the fulfilling of wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood in a moment. They're fulfilled by abstaining. So essentially, in a moment when you are abstaining from unwholesome speech, when you're abstaining from killing living beings, when you're abstaining from taking what's not given, when you're abstaining from sexual misconduct, in a moment, you are practicing wise speech and wise action. Wise livelihood, he connected with the fact that you're here on retreat, living a Dharma life. Living the life of monks and nuns, essentially, for this time here on retreat. And that's wise livelihood. So it's helpful, actually, to appreciate the fact, kind of as a support for us, a confidence booster in a way, that we don't actually often think about the fact that something isn't present is a positive thing or a wholesome thing. We don't even think about things that aren't present. And so reminding yourself, reflecting on the fact that as you live here for these days, you're engaging in wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, just by your being here. And we can also look at service, the service that we're all offering here as livelihood. Our sangha service, our yogi jobs, the offerings, generosity and service, both are part of wise livelihood. The intention to support the Dharma through our actions is wise livelihood. And so it's not just refraining from things, not just refraining from unwholesome speech or refraining from killing living beings or taking what's not given or sexual misconduct, not just refraining from, but there's also an active cultivation of wise livelihood through the intention of kindness, of generosity, and of compassion. And our service here, this whole center has come together through wise intention. I find that so amazing. So we are cultivating this ethical conduct aspect of the Eightfold Path here on retreat. And perhaps most obviously, moment after moment, we're cultivating wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. Every moment that we bring our attention to our experience, every moment that we wake up and recognize, ah, oh, here I am again. I was lost a moment ago, but here I am now. I'm back. I'm present. What's happening now? Every moment we do that, we're practicing wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. So the Eightfold Path, the practices of the Eightfold Path, tend to lead us, guide us, actually kinds of turns a battleship. It's a slow process, turning our minds towards more calm, more peace, more happiness. Settles mental reactivity, which makes us feel happier in our lives. And there's some benefit just in kind of in our ordinary lives of engaging with these practices. And the Eightfold Path is understood to lead to the deepest kind of freedom. Liberation, enlightenment. What is this? What is this freedom? What is this liberation, enlightenment? When I was younger, before I really had even met the teachings of the Buddha, I heard the word enlightenment, and I kind of had this idea. It meant like, you know, some brain-exploding experience. Lots of light involved, of course. And that ever after, whoever had that experience would be like always happy. Kind of like Ajahn Pasanom said last night, yeah, you know, if I do this right, I'll always be happy for the rest of my life. And so, you know, just some kind of like a floating on a cloud down the road or whatever, you know, just some idea that that's what it meant. You know, kind of transcending the world. I kind of had this idea that enlightenment meant something like elevating above the world and floating around. And then in meeting the Buddhist teachings and discovering what the Buddha defined as enlightenment, it's really, really practical, really simple definition. He describes it as the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. And I like this because it seems possible to me to envision living in this world, being engaged in activities in the world, and being free of greed, aversion, and delusion. It seems to me that that definition brings this enlightenment into contact with what I think of as reality, as opposed to mind-blowing transcendence floating around in some ether, you know. So to me, this definition really grounds it in experience, moment to moment, the possibility of freedom of greed from greed, aversion, and delusion. I'm going to read a couple of texts about this. The extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of delusion. This, indeed, is called nibbana. Enraptured with lust, enraged with anger, blinded by delusion, overwhelmed, with mind ensnared, one aims at one's own ruin, at the ruin of others, at the ruin of both, and experiences mental pain and grief. But if lust, anger, and delusion are given up, one aims neither at one's own ruin, at the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both, and experiences no mental pain and grief. This is nibbana, immediate, visible in this life, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise. So here the Buddha says, Nibbana is immediate, visible in this life. Again, that sense of not something we have to float away with. It's not the die and go to heaven model. Visible in this life. And this description also, so the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. He says the experience of that is no mental pain and grief. That sounds pretty good to me. So this possibility of freedom. Freedom from mental pain and grief. So since this root of our struggles, I mean, the Buddha described that suffering comes from greed, aversion, and delusion. That the root of suffering is greed, aversion, and delusion. And so it is the extinction of those that brings our freedom, our happiness. And so since the root of suffering, the root of this dukkha, is greed, aversion, and delusion, we might ask, how does the Noble Eightfold Path help us to end greed, aversion, and delusion? So there's a teaching, I think it's from the commentaries, the Buddhist commentaries, about how the ways that we get caught, the term that's often, the Pali term that's often used for being caught in many assorted mind states, the things that we're caught by are kilesa. A typical translation for that word is defilement. Sometimes that's kind of an icky sounding word. But as one friend said, well, they're icky. They are icky. So there's a teaching around these defilements, and we can think about defilements as being those states that keep our minds from clarity, those states that keep our minds from purity. There's a teaching about these defilements that they kind of are layered. They come in layers. Three layers are described in the commentaries. There's kind of the most obvious layer, which is described as the layer of acting out, where these states, these defilements, kind of come out into our behavior, impel us to act. And this happens to us a lot, especially before we meet the practice. Our habits, our tendencies of mind, just are kind of running the show, and we end up acting out of those tendencies. So there's this level, the most obvious level, this level of, it's called the level of transgression, where we act out of greed or aversion or delusion in body and speech. A bit more subtle level of the defilements is when they come into our minds, but they don't kind of leak out into our actions. So this is where they're manifesting. They're coming up into our minds, so we feel them, we experience them. But perhaps there's a level of training that we see them before we start acting on them. And then there's the most subtle layer of these defilements, which is what it's called, the latent tendency to these states of mind. Now this is, I think, something we all know, we're all familiar with. You know, we all have our own habits and patterns of things that we kind of tend to get caught in. And, you know, we may have times where we're not caught in that state. But we know our hearts. We know that, yeah, the reason it's not happening right now is because conditions are kind of ideal right now. You know, things are going well for me right now. And so this state, this, you know, this pattern that's so familiar doesn't happen to be being triggered right now. But we know that given a shift of conditions, it's very easy for that pattern to kind of start to unfold. For me, this one of these patterns was anger. Very easy for me to slip into anger. And so, you know, there was what would be called a latent tendency to anger when it wasn't active. So there are times when these defilements aren't present in our mind in a moment, but it's kind of like the grooves are there. And it doesn't take much for us to fall into those ruts. So the latent tendencies are kind of like those grooves. They're not; they may not be active in a moment, but they're easy to get caught in. So these three layers of defilements, each one of these layers of defilement is met by one of the three aspects of the Eightfold Path. So the most obvious aspect, the most obvious way that defilement comes out in the level of transgression is met by the ethical conduct section of the Eightfold Path. The more subtle manifestation where they're arising in our minds is met by the mental cultivation aspect and the latent tendency, that deeper root, is met by the wisdom aspect of the Eightfold Path. And I'd like to just explore that briefly with you, how that works, what's the understanding there. So, ethical conduct, you know, the kind of commitment to the precepts really supports our not acting out, not transgressing when these difficult energies arise. If we are committed to refraining from, so this is, you know, this is wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. We're committed to refraining from unskillful actions that would cause harm, then we are really countering some of those tendencies for those defilements to come out in our actions. In a way, the precepts serve almost as a little mindfulness bell for us. You know, if we find ourselves wandering into the terrain where we may be in a place of getting ready to hit that spider on the wall, it's like, wait a minute, okay. I'm not going to do that. So it helps to prevent us from following through on a mental energy that is not so wholesome. The mental cultivation aspect of the Eightfold Path, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, also I find counters this tendency towards acting out. Because as we cultivate our mindfulness and begin to understand our minds and begin to see and get familiar with our own familiar habitual tendencies, our own favorite ways that we get caught, the more we practice mindfulness of those tendencies, the more it's like those tendencies then serve as mindfulness bells. This is a great thing. You know, I find actually one of the things that will wake me up now out of non-awareness is when suffering arises. You know, some energy or impulsion of mind in motivated by greed, aversion, delusion. It's like, whoa, wake up. There's suffering that's kind of coming up in my experience. So the mental cultivation helps us to abstain from this acting out level because we can see these tendencies in our mind before we act. This is a huge benefit of the practice. that we can begin to see what's happening in our minds, and knowing that, we can choose. Do I want to act or not? So seeing how our minds work, we begin to have choice as to whether to act. The mental cultivation aspect also counters the tendency for these qualities in our minds, these difficulties, kilesa. As we practice wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, the mind settles down. As the mind becomes concentrated, the hindrances, the difficult states that, you know, five difficult states, wow. Sense, desire, ill will, restlessness, sloth and torpor, and doubt. Those difficult states of mind, as the mind becomes concentrated, those difficult states fall away. There's a seclusion from those kinds of energies of mind. Really feels good. Feels so good. It's even got a name, the bliss of seclusion. The seclusion from these unwholesome states. Like Ajahn Pasano said last night, you know, the things that we are renouncing are the things that we really don't want around anyway. So the cultivation of wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration begins to give us a taste of what it feels like to not have defilements so present in the mind. And of course, that is temporary. For the subtlest level, the subtlest level of defilement, to kind of begin to pull that apart, to begin to uproot those tendencies, those latent tendencies towards these unwholesome states, it takes a radical shift of understanding. It takes a transformative understanding. It takes wisdom, this last aspect of the Eightfold Path. It takes wisdom to uproot greed, aversion, and delusion and pull out those latent tendencies so that it's almost like we couldn't go there anymore. My understanding, we couldn't go there anymore. So that kind of fundamental reshaping, that shift of understanding, is not a shift that happens just because we think about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. It's a shift of understanding that happens as we directly experience the truth of dukkha, the truth of the cause of dukkha. We directly experience how dukkha is constructed and begin to see how it's possible for it to let go. So this doesn't happen through thinking about. It happens through direct seeing. So wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, this mental cultivation aspect, kind of creates the conditions, creates the soil in which this wisdom can take root, which this wisdom can grow. The wisdom begins to uproot greed, aversion, and delusion through undermining ignorance. This is, you can think of ignorance as being at the core of greed, aversion, and delusion. Our usual understanding, or often we think about ignorance as being a lack of knowledge, a kind of a passive state of not knowing something. But the ignorance that underlies greed, aversion, and delusion is much more insidious than that. It's an active misunderstanding, an active misperception, an active confusion that impacts the way we perceive things, think about things, and respond to things. Three of the primary misunderstandings are that we tend to take what is impermanent to be permanent, We tend to take what is unreliable to be a reliable source of happiness. We tend to take what is not self to be self. So wisdom and mental cultivation together begin to support a shift of understanding around these misperceptions. As we train the mind, this very exploration of our experience begins to reveal our experience to be a river, a stream, a flow, ever changing. Nothing lasts for even a moment. It's unsatisfactory. We see that because things are impermanent, flowing, changing, that there's no way they can be a source of happiness. They're inherently unreliable because they're so unstable. And when we look too, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, when I say that, we can think about, you know, trying to hold on to things in the world that are changing. You know, hold on to physical experience or something like that. But most of what we actually try to hold on to, what our minds are doing as they're trying to hold on to something, is that the mind is constructing an idea of something, and it's trying to hold on to that. So, you know, that new car or whatever, you know, that new thing that you have. You know, there may be some attachment to the actual thing itself, but mostly, if you actually look in your minds, it's not so much that you're attached to the actual physical thing, you're attached to the idea of what it does for you, of what it makes you look like, of how other people feel about you. So it's more that we're attached to constructs of our own mind. And so we suffer because we hold on to things that are impermanent. And not only that, the things that we hold on to are created by our own minds. And we take what is not self to be self. The exploration of our experience begins to reveal that what we think of as self, what we think of as me, as some enduring entity that has control over itself, doesn't. If you know, try running a few experiments. Okay, so I'm going to sit here and meditate, and this is what I'm going to do. I am going to be present for the next, pick a short time, 2 minutes. And then see if you can do it. You know, you'll likely find, I mean, we can get to the place where we can be present for 2 minutes, but we do not have control over our minds. So the mind wanders. You know, if the I was the one choosing to sit here and meditate and say, I'm going to stay here, be present for 2 minutes, then who was it that wandered? And even more amazing, who woke up? I mean, there was no control over that either. So, you know, this act of sitting down to meditate begins to undermine our sense of being in control, of being a thing. Anytime we start looking at what we take to be self, we see that it shifts and changes. Within a split second, it can go from... I remember on one retreat, I was doing walking meditation out in front of IMS, and it was a 3-month retreat, and I was caught in my mind because I was having an argument with one of the yogis who kept asking questions in the hall in the morning. You know, I would see this. I'd see I was caught, and then I would feel into what it felt like to be caught. And, you know, it really felt like I was a 40-year-old argumentative, intellectual, analytical, you know, those pieces came together in that moment. That's what it felt like. That was me in that moment. And, you know, going, feeling that, and then back into the argument, and then back, what does this feel like? Then back into the argument, back and forth like this. And then doing the walking meditation, things happen, you know. A truck drives up, and it's a big, loud truck. And, you know, within a moment, my mind went, oh, it's a truck! Wow! I shifted from being a 40-year-old argumentative to a 2-year-old. You know, just like that. So this practice begins to reveal to us this, what we take to be self. If you start exploring that, what you take to be self, you find it changes. It doesn't last. It's not very stable. So the path begins and ends with wisdom. It begins with the intellectual understanding, and through the cultivation, through walking the Eightfold Path, we begin to see for ourselves, we begin to see how our experience changes. We begin to see into these primary distortions of our mind. It begins to uproot this latent tendency towards greed, aversion, and delusion. When we understand that things are impermanent, unreliable, and not self, the mind begins to recognize, and you don't have to do this, you know, it's not something that I do, but the mind itself gets an education that unreliable things aren't worth holding on to. That holding on to things, pushing them away, is not a very effective path to happiness. So the mind gets an education in this. This begins to uproot that those latent tendencies. Because the mind itself begins to see the ineffectual strategy of that direction. And when the mind understands that what we think of as self isn't what it is, it's just an unfolding process, then again, it starts to see there's no need to hold on to anything. Much of greed and aversion is rooted in this misunderstanding of not of self. If there's an understanding around this self is simply a process, there's no one to defend, there's no one to protect. Just not a problem. No self, no problem. So the mind begins to understand that clinging and craving are pointless. Begins to understand the joy of letting go. I had a new way of thinking about the transformation of letting go this morning. We'd like to let go. We'd like to figure out how to do that. And, you know, actually the untrained mind has figured out its own strategies for dealing with the world. You know, the untrained mind, before we meet the Dharma, this is the mind that we have to work with when we meet the Dharma. The untrained mind, when it meets a difficult experience or a difficult state of mind, such as anger, you know, the untrained mind's initial response is to try to fix or change the situation, perhaps. And if we can't do that, then sometimes the mind will choose to pick up something else. Have you ever noticed that? You know, that if there's something hard going on, you might find this kind of, I think this came in because of what Ajahn Pasano said last night about, you know, for what Ajahn Chah said to somebody about working with anger. Set an alarm clock for 2 hours and see if it lasts, you know. It's like, what happens in that 2 hours? The mind basically picks up something else instead of the thing that we're angry about. So, you know, in a way, the mind has learned a strategy for letting go of anger or any difficult state by picking up something else. And the Buddha pointed to this. He said that an untrained person escapes unpleasant experience by gravitating towards pleasant experience. So this is what the untrained mind does. You know, in the untrained mind, the impermanence of a difficult state is seen when hours later you realize, oh, where did it go? I was so angry an hour or two ago, and now I'm not. You know, it disappeared somewhere. So understanding that the untrained mind knows that letting go can be helpful. You know, knows that, for instance, anger isn't so helpful or holding on to this situation isn't so helpful. It would be helpful to let go of it. But the untrained mind doesn't have a clue how to let go except by picking something else up. And so we do that a lot. But knowing something about this tendency of our mind to let go of things by picking something else up, we can engage in that skillfully as a part of our training. You know, if a difficult state is overwhelming, if it's hard to be with, if it's hard to be mindful of, we can, knowing that, you know, it's easier for the mind to put something down when it picks something else up, consciously pick up something other than that difficult state. Pick up some neutral experience. Pick up the experience of hearing. Be mindful for something consciously, kind of a redirecting of the attention, helping your mind to put that difficult thing down by consciously picking up something that's skillful, mindfully picking up something that's helpful, rather than letting your habits of mind decide what to pick up, which is what our mind tends to do. You know, we're ruminating about anger, and then we find ourselves ruminating about some fantasy instead, something. Yeah. You know your minds. How does it work for you? And as the mind develops in training, as we deepen in our practice, we are able to observe difficult states of mind. We're able to observe the kilesa, even strong states, strong difficult states. We learn, it's kind of like putting the gears into neutral, you know, that there's a kind of a momentum to our difficult states that is being fed when we're not mindful. And when we become mindful, I kind of look at mindfulness as kind of like disengaging the gears. We're not feeding it anymore. And so we've put the gears into neutral. That pattern is still kind of unfolding. It's still unwinding. But it's no longer being propelled. So we've kind of put the gears into neutral. And we learn to watch those difficult states. And because they are impermanent, they will disappear. So we begin to learn, what does it mean to pay attention to something until it lets go? It lets go of itself. And this, what does it mean? What happens in your mind when the mind lets go without picking something else up? What is that? What is that moment when the mind lets go and hasn't picked something else up? I think that's a pointer to absence of greed, absence of aversion, absence of delusion. I think that's a pointer to what the Buddha was talking about. No mental pain and grief. This letting go of the moment when the mind releases, lets go. Being present for that. Typically what happens is we lose the mind. It's such a subtle experience, the mind letting go, that the mind will kind of pick up on something else before it fully sees that experience let go. But this is our training, and this is my part of my understanding of how the practice leads us to the deepest release, the deepest happiness, is through being able to stay with our experience, to see those moments when the mind lets go without picking up something else. So, thank you for your attention.